The Weapon of Humour. And now we come to the strangest skirmish of all in the battle for the reformation of the Church. Enter one Martin Marprelate, gentleman, a character of fiction in a sense, but one whose works, or rather whose writings, were real enough. Marprelate, a name conjured up from the two words mar and prelate. Mar, to ruin, to impair the perfection of, to spoil, to disfigure. Prelate, a high ecclesiastical dignitary, such as a bishop. Hence Marprelate, one who spoils, disfigures, or impairs the perfection of bishops and other church bigwigs. Who was Martin Marprelate, gentlemen? Ah, who indeed? Nobody ever found out. The general opinion at the time, the received view, was that he was John Penry. He always denied it. Granted that, it all depends on what question he was asked, does it not? Whether Penry was Martin or not was never proved. In any case, proof did not matter. Suspicion was enough for Archbishop Whitgift's purpose. Somebody had to pay. That somebody was John Penry. He was hanged. As I explained in the previous chapter, Penry published a petition to the Queen and Parliament in March 1587, in which he appealed for preachers of the gospel to be sent into Wales. For that offence he was imprisoned and tried under the Star Chamber Decree of 1586. This trial, with its related public notoriety, brought Penry to the attention of certain Puritans and led to further contact between them and Penry. One of the men involved was John Udall, a Puritan minister at Kingston-on-Thames. He had also published secretly and illegally, in his case a treatise advocating Presbyterianism. Udall was eventually sentenced to death on suspicion of being Martin, but it was commuted, and he died in prison in 1592. King James of Scotland called him the greatest scholar in Europe. Another member of the group was the witty Job Throgmorton, a learned and eloquent Oxford graduate, a Puritan landowner, and an MP. Another was the Puritan printer Robert Wardegrave. It is likely that the four met at Kingston, where they decided upon a plan to prosecute the next stage in the battle to recover New Testament church life. They would do this by the publication of anti-clerical literature. Throckmorton supplied the money to buy a printing press, and by the autumn of 1588, they were ready. A golden opportunity awaited them. The Anglican Dr. Bridges, Dean of Salisbury, had published a book in 1587 entitled A Defence of the Government of the Church of England, a ponderous volume of over 1,400 pages. Truly, it was a ridiculous effort. One sentence was actually 150 words long. It was incomprehensible. This massive tome was a sitting target, and Martin let fly in November 1588 with both barrels. He simply couldn't miss. Thus, out of the blue, an anonymous tract appeared on the market, said to be published at the cost of Martin Marprelate, gentlemen. This illegal tract poked fun at Bridges' volume, mocking the work mercilessly. The upstart publication was a piece of pure genius in satire, clearly showing that Martin possessed a ready wit and the gift of plain speaking. Bridges' attempted defence of the state church met with short shrift. Nor did Martin confine his attention to the learned doctor. He mauled the bishops too, quoting their own sermons in books back at them, accusing them of hypocrisy and worse, giving chapter and verse to support his claims. He deridingly addressed them as brethren bishops, my learned brethren, while calling himself your brother Martin. Meanwhile, the secret press moved location, and in December 1588, another tract appeared. The press moved again, and in February 1589, a third tract was published. A fourth quickly followed. Martin was no fool, whoever he was. Neither was he interested in a joke for a joke's sake. He did not lampoon the bishops just to get a laugh. He had a serious purpose in hand. He said he was determined that the arguments about the reformation of the church should be more widely known and discussed by the man in the street, not buried in ponderous tomes read only by the few. He set out to make the subject popular, in the right sense. He understood enough to pick out the point at issue between Whitgift and the Puritans, which was whether the government of the Church of England be a thing so prescribed by the Lord in the New Testament, as it is not lawful for any man to alter the same. Martin knew that his mockery angered the Anglicans and the Puritans, both Episcopalian and Presbyterian, and that many Puritans objected to his humorous approach. He justified himself by arguing that a jest was lawful in the circumstances, and he made sure that he never profaned the word of God. He replied to his critics by saying, "The Puritans are angry with me. I mean the Puritan preachers. And why? Because I am too open. Because I jest. I jested because I dealt with a worshipful jester, Dr. Bridges, whose writings and sermons tend to no other end than to make men laugh. I am plain. I must needs call a spade a spade. There be many that greatly dislike of my doings. I may have my wants, I know, for I am a man, but my course I know to be ordinary and lawful. I saw the cause of Christ's government, and of the bishop's anti-Christian dealing, to be hidden. The most part of men could not be gotten to read anything written in the defence of one against the other. I bethought me, therefore, of a way men might be drawn to do both, perceiving the humours of man in these times to be given to mirth. I took that course. I might lawfully do it. Jesting is lawful by circumstances, even in the greatest matters. I never profane the word of God in any jests. The Lord being the author both of mirth and gravity, is it not lawful in itself for the truth to use either of these ways when the circumstances do make it lawful?" Martin nailed Whitgift along with Aylmer, Bishop of London, whom he accused of being a dumb minister, one who used profane language, who did not pay the bills of tradesmen. He further accused him of stealing a piece of cloth, playing bowls on Sundays, and selling the timber from church estates to line his pocket with the proceeds. Now Aylmer, as a bishop, was known to be severe against any who disagreed with him, handing out heavy fines and imprisonment. For this Martin was scathing, quoting Aylmer's own book back at him, written when he, Aylmer, was a Marian exile and sympathetic to reform. In another passage, Martin was caustic over a grovelling sermon preached by the Bishop of Gloucester, the main point of which seemed to be the meaning and distinction attached to the name John, John being the first name of both Whitgift and Aylmer, of course. Others came in for rough treatment, too. The Bishop of St. David's was a bigamist. There was the notorious scandal over the Bishop of Winchester's wife, and so it went on. Martin promised that if the bishops would encourage preaching, get rid of popish garments, grant him an amnesty, then he would stop. If not, the hatred which Martin aroused was immense. Whitgift was incensed. He was livid. He ordered his spies to catch Martin, and they certainly did their best. Throughout 1589 they tried their utmost, hunting high and low. Waldegrave went to France. Penry dodged from place to place, but the output of tracts continued. Two more appeared in July 1589. Then another. The press was seized, but a replacement press, poorer but usable, produced two more tracts, the last in September 1589. Thus seven tracts came out in about 10 months. Penry, in disguise, had been constantly on the move in fear of his life, but the tracts kept coming. Not only that, Penry was also publishing works under his own name. The Mar Prelate tracts certainly accomplished what their author intended. He ensured that the knowledge of the details of the controversies concerning the reformation of the church did spread far and wide. His stout blows against the stuffy pomposity of the bishops brought a new dimension to the whole question. Martin's blunt speaking, his sharp and stinging satire, made for bright, racy reading. He was no mealy-mouthed wit, nor did he pull any punches. He named names. He offered an open kind of blackmail, which highly amused his public. a bloated bishop, would be warned in one tract that unless he mended his ways, further revelations would follow. The tracts were impertinent, full of spicy stories and gossipy scandal. Martin was an impudent fellow, and make no mistake, the popularity of the tracts was immense. The man's sheer cheek, his daring, brought delight to everybody. Well, almost everybody. Queen Elizabeth and her flunkies read them with much interest. University scholars concealed them under their gowns, studied them, and sniggered in secret. High and low pored over their pages. From the court to the cottage, from the peasant's hovel to the university hall, the bishops found that everybody was ridiculing them. Martin brought to light the scandals of the bishops, their carnality, and their hypocrisy. The prelates became a laughingstock. The abuses and corruptions of the Church of England became the stuff of common gossip. Then, in 1559, a book was published against the tracts which accused Penry, naming him as Martin. His house was ransacked, and an order was issued for his arrest. The chase was on. He fled to Scotland, where his Puritan sympathies ensured him a warm welcome, since, as already noted, at that time he was no separatist. Indeed, Martin had attacked Barrow. All the while Penry was on the run, he continued to preach and to publish yet more works. As I explained in the previous chapter, Penry eventually came to London to seek permission from the Queen that he might return to Wales as a preacher. From a personal point of view, it was a most unwise decision, but the spiritual plight of his fellow countrymen proved too strong for him. The risk he took in coming back to England was immense, for, to cap it all, when he was in London, he showed he had now become a separatist. He was arrested. Although it was never proved, it is almost certain that Penry was Martin. Penry certainly played a large part in the whole affair. He denied it, but of course, as I've said, it all depends on the exact question that he was asked. Whitgift's rage was unbounded. The lustre of the dignity of the bishops had been tarnished, and the bubble of their inflated pride had been pricked by the tracts. But at last, he had Martin Marprelate in his grasp, or so he was convinced. Whitgift was full of spite. He was bent on vengeance. There was no escape. Martin Prelate would write no more. John Penry was hanged in 1593.